The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
I'm Leigh Alexander. Thanks for joining us. This week on the show...
So the invention of air conditioning is directly related to the election of Ronald Reagan. You would have never predicted this
never.
In advance. You couldn't see, you know, you couldn't think about it. All that has made me more humble about making any prediction about what's really going to happen.
Tech and science writer Stephen Johnson discusses the six major innovations that made the modern world, all part of his brand new book, How We Got to Now. Also, we discuss why UK's top spy, Robert Hannigan, has the leading US social networks in his line of rhetorical fire, what Alex from Target tells us about online random fame, and why Taylor Swift and Spotify have fallen out. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Gathered around the tech table here at Guardian HQ, I have the leading resident tech thinkers.
Hi, I'm Alex Hearn. I'm a tech reporter.
Not from Target.
Not from Target.
And we have Elena Cressy. Hi, Elena.
Hello.
Let's kick off with the article written by the new spy chief, director of GCHQ, Robert Hannigan, on why privacy has never been, quote, an absolute right, and why technology companies are in denial about the misuse of their services. Alex, Robert Hannigan thinks he's got the public on his side on this, does he not?
Yes, he does. One of the points he makes is that actually he thinks that essentially Silicon Valley discourse has become disconnected from how especially the British public view things. The British public is willing to make a trade-off on privacy versus security, and that, as he says, they have the strong views on the ethics of companies, whether on taxation, child protection, or privacy. They don't want the media platforms they use with their friends and families to facilitate murder or child abuse. In other words, what he's saying is similar to what you've heard from governments for the last few years, that people, when they are told, oh, you know, this privacy which you've been pushing for, this actually also enables groups like ISIS, they are more willing to make a trade-off on that than maybe Facebook, Twitter, or WhatsApp, which is a subsidiary of Facebook, than those three companies are.
So it seems like, you know, people are having to think about whether we're trading off privacy for security, for example, if you want to look into who's making threats online to you, you know, if their privacy is fully protected, you may never find out. Is that the issue we're kind of dealing with here?
Right. And the thing is, he's not the first person to have brought this up by any means, but other people have brought it up in a slightly more critical way of the security services, the Obama administration being the most notorious example. In the administration's report after the Snowden leaks, they made the point that there is a very weird combination of responsibilities that America's National Security Agency has. It's both in charge of cybersecurity, so protecting our data, and in charge of gathering the information required to fight terrorism. Those two goals aren't always working in the same direction and frequently are the exact opposite. The example I've heard from a tech industry insider today, which really brings this to a head, is about banking. One of the easiest and most efficient ways of shutting down terrorism is to go after the money, attack it at its root, attack the people who finance it. It would be very, very easy to do that if every banking transaction was conducted entirely in the clear. But at the same time, it's certainly not good for cybersecurity if you remove all of the protections on your internet banking, if you make all of your passcodes open.
Right,
that's incredibly bad for security. So that's more than just a trade-off. That is an absolute head-to-head thing. And in America and in Britain, the same agency is responsible for both of those things. So what actually that means is that we have, to a certain extent, offloaded the ability to even make that trade-off to one group. And that group, it seems, views cybersecurity as its secondary priority, and its first priority is fighting terrorism.
Interesting. So what are the roles of the platform holders such as Facebook and Twitter going to be in this ongoing conversation?
Right. Well, this is the problem. I mean, the way the social networks view it is they view themselves as a subsection of the internet. They're very eager to point out that any criticism you make of them in particular can actually be made of the internet overall. So if you say Facebook is being used by ISIS, well, okay, but if ISIS is using Facebook, they also must have phones and computers to use Facebook. Are we saying that phones and computers are bad because ISIS uses them? The tech companies at least go, no, that is a ridiculous point. Actually, you know, Facebook is a good thing. Facebook has been overwhelmingly good. Twitter has been overwhelmingly good. Even maybe sites like Reddit have been overwhelmingly good, but they are abused, used and abused by minority. And that actually, so long as the social networks are doing their best to fight that minority, they think they can hold their head up high and turn to both people like GCHQ and their customers and say, look, we are doing the best we can. And actually, they have a point, of course, because it's far easier to fight misuse of Facebook, to fight misuse of Twitter, than it is to fight misuse of a decentralized technology like the internet at large. At least Facebook and Twitter can block users from their site. They can find and remove objectionable content. That is, if you're trying to say something that they don't want you to say, a bad thing. But in this situation, they've kind of got a point.
Yeah, they can. And their management of questionable content tends to be inconsistent. People can be banned for posting pictures of their undressed children on Facebook that are totally innocent. But then, you know, if someone sends you incredibly abusive invective on Twitter, we can't find and ban or press charges against someone making a threat in that environment.
Quite. We're in an interesting situation where actually they... We're in an interesting situation where they have the ability to do a lot more than they do in some situations. And in other situations, they do really wish they could block more than they can. I think the two areas where their rhetoric and abilities really do match up, all of the major social networks, are child protection and terrorism. On both of those, they really do seem to be not dragging their feet. They want that off their services as much as anyone else does. Where it gets more questionable or where you get further down the line. So, for instance, actually enabling terrorism is one thing, but Twitter took a while to decide whether or not videos of Western journalists being executed counted as terrorism or news content. In the end, Twitter's Dick Costolo essentially made a decree from on high that that wasn't content he wanted on his social network. But then you get all the way down to the other end where, yes, Facebook has been dealing with breastfeeding images as though it's sort of a child protection issue. And that does seem a bit odd. So if you're arguing for more power to be handed over to Facebook to remove more objectionable content, we have to be aware that that comes with handing over the ability to decide what objectionable content is to Facebook as well.
Elena, what are your thoughts on anonymity versus security?
It depends really what we're talking about. Sometimes we have people who talk to us through the site, through our comments, who will share experiences and they will not want to be named as a result. And it, you know, for example, we've done projects around mental health. People don't often want to put their name to the submission. I mean, obviously, we do sort of the journalistic background work where we talk to the person, check that everything is correct. But that's one example of where internet anonymity can really be a valuable thing. But it's kind of, it's difficult when it comes to things like abuse, because you can't justify it. You can't at all, not in the slightest. And just picking up on what Alex was saying earlier, I mean, our community team has done little bits and bobs around ISIS on social media. And, you know, for one, they're extremely good at it. It's only lately that Twitter has really sort of cracked down on them. And it's difficult because we were seeing a lot of this content. We were seeing a lot of graphic content and Twitter weren't really doing anything about it. Or if they were, they were very slow to do it. And it wasn't until James Foley, until that whole thing happened, that they actually started cracking down on it.
The James Foley situation, of course, is that of the journalist who was murdered in Syria.
So I find it very difficult to sort of look at Twitter and think that they're doing a good job, because it's so they pick and choose what will be published and what won't. And Facebook does it too.
And that makes it challenging for people on the journalism side of things to research stories and choose what should be published.
Absolutely.
Just because something is happening in the public space, does that make it news? And does Twitter get to decide what's visible and what's not?
Exactly. And Twitter don't, you know, they don't obviously, for various reasons, don't let journalists see the archive tweets that have been deleted. I don't even know if that's possible. But they sort of shut down a little bit when we've sort of requested that. Not because we want to publish it, but because we want to understand how this goes. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, there's a great department at King's College that have been doing loads of research into British fighters that have gone out to Syria, and it's been mostly based on social networks and on their social networking profiles. But if you're sort of you know, habitually deleting them and not really saving that information anywhere, then how are you going to understand? Because a lot of it is about not necessarily, you know, letting, you know, free speech or anything like that. It's just about understanding and making it seem less like this massive terror threat. Maybe if you understand it a bit more, it seems a little bit less scary.
Well, certainly there's a lot going on in this ever-evolving debate between online privacy and national security. For more on the story, go to theguardian.com/technology. Is it a diva-style tantrum, or is it a reassessment of the music industry's profit model? This week, Taylor Swift, Swift by name, Swift by nature, pulled her entire back catalog from the Spotify music streaming service. We're all big fans of Taylor here.
I love her. Yeah. She's so great.
Elena, would you like to give us the details on her decision?
Taylor Swift or her label have always had quite a weird relationship with Spotify. Things sort of appear and disappear off it quite a lot, and recently they've decided just to pull her entire back catalogue from Spotify, the streaming service.
And what predicated that?
I'm not sure exactly. I think they're more about getting fans to buy the music rather than stream it. And I know that Taylor Swift obviously wrote that big piece about modern music.
Yeah, in July she wrote for the Washington Post a quite a forthright examination of where streaming services and buy-to-own services fit in, and not just as a business decision but as an artistic decision. She is a strong defender of the concept of the album as a whole rather than a disconnected collection of songs which may or may not eventually be released as hit singles in their own right.
She said an album is a work of art, and art is valuable and important things should be paid for, she said.
Exactly. So I think...
Paraphrasing.
I think... Red, her previous album, was withheld from Spotify for a bit. That also happened in 1989 this time. That's a fairly standard practice for major releases called windowing. The idea being that, you know, you want to keep it off the streaming services just long enough to encourage the massive fans to actually chip in and buy the album, and then you make it available to everyone else. So you do a segmented release, you get streaming plays from the casual fans and actual money from the major fans. Then what happened is last week her label told Spotify that the whole thing would be coming off.
I believe there was some kind of exchange between them publicly, like in response to her assertions about the value of music, Spotify insisted that it pays 70% of revenues to its artists.
So this has been it's a common refrain from it. And also after 1989 wasn't made available on the site, Spotify again did lots of public, you know, slightly jokey but also vaguely pleady tweets.
They have
blog
pressured
posts.
Her quite a bit in public.
Yeah, saying put 1989 on. Apparently, according to Music Ally, there were talks between Swift's camp and Spotify of putting 1989 on Spotify early, only for premium subscribers. In other words, that would be an attempt to square the circle there.
Lena, why do you think Taylor has this level of power and control to do such a, you know, unprecedented public move with her music?
Well, for starters, she's great. I think that goes
can't
without
argue
saying.
With you there.
But I think she has got that kind of star power where she can kind of make a big move like this and make a stand, so to speak. I mean, for me, I think it's a big shame, but I'm a bit biased because I do use Spotify and it is the sort of main streaming service that I use. So it's kind of difficult to, you know, square with the fact that I'm no longer going to be able to listen to her music. But for her, I mean, she's going to want people to buy her album. She's going to want people to actually pay for it. And I think that's fair enough. But I think the reason that she can make that demand is because she's just got such a huge following. I mean, I can't think of another artist like Taylor Swift that's managed to capture the internet's imagination. And it's quite hard to get people on the internet to pay for things. And this is kind of her saying, well, no, actually, you really should pay for it. And I think that's really interesting.
Is this a requisition she can make of her audience without suffering backlash?
Well, she did manage to sell, I think it was 1.3 million copies in the US alone in the first week.
Wow.
It's almost certainly the biggest first week album by a solo female since Britney Spears's Oops, I Did It Again.
Wow.
And it might beat that. It might be the biggest selling solo woman ever. It might be the biggest selling solo album by a woman ever. That That alone kind of tells you the amount of sway she has there. There are 1.3 million people who bought it in the first week, who essentially bought it sight unseen. They'd heard the singles, that there was no, oh, I'll give it a go. There was no stream it on Spotify for a month and they buy it. These people just went out and bought it.
Because her singles were on Spotify. She had two very popular singles come out to sort of tease the album, and most people were sort of primed for purchase.
Yeah. I mean, one interesting thing is, in the run-up to this album, she already had a slight misstep by the fans when the second song from the album, Out of the Woods, was released to American customers who pre-ordered it, but not British ones. That actually caused Swift to take to Tumblr to issue a sort of apology to her fans, an apology without actually saying the word sorry, where she explained that her label was trying a new strategy and it would work very well for Ed Sheeran in the past, and that British fans would have to wait until the album came out to actually hear the song.
I hadn't even heard about that, so it shows how upset people must have been.
But the difference between this and that is that now we've heard nothing from Swift. And talking about her as an internet savvy pop star, this strikes me as very odd.
She's
open with her fans, and it's been shock horror 24 whole hours since it was taken off Spotify, and there's been nothing from her label, nothing from her fans, and one weird overly chummy blog post from Spotify itself.
And they actually now they started a playlist called While You Wait for Taylor to Come Back, which is I think a bit too much public pressure from the company.
In terms of other public pressure, the other very interesting thing is Spotify's response has largely been, we're bad, what about YouTube? Spotify's the founder, Daniel Ek, has been retweeting left, right and centre, and actually himself tweeted and then deleted, which is always that little bit of frisson.
Speaking of deleted tweets.
Tweeted and deleted a screenshot of YouTube, what you get if you search for Taylor Swift 1989 full album, which is, of course, a ton of 90-minute YouTube videos with the whole album on it, playable for free, unlicensed, but still a little bit of revenue feeding back to Taylor Swift's label through YouTube's Content ID system.
Interesting. Do you think that this could be the harbinger of reform for streaming services, or does Taylor Swift just get a special set of rules?
I've got to say, I think it's probably the latter. I think in terms of what the outcome of this will be, I think part of the outcome will be Taylor Swift gets richer. I think for her as an individual artist, this is probably a good move. She has a diehard fan base who will buy albums. She will have grown her diehard fan base with this album, and she's now got a back catalogue that she's hoping to sell them as well. And she's well known enough that there's not really a critical mass of people who want to, ooh, who's this Taylor Swift person? Let's listen on Spotify before buying. If you're ever going to buy a Taylor Swift album, you probably know what her music sounds like by now. And if you really don't, you still have YouTube, you still have the radio, you're going to be able to find out some way. I think broader than that, if you're not Taylor Swift, if you're not selling 1.3 million albums in your first week in the US, you can't copy her. This is something that she can do. It's basically, what this is it's 2014's version of Radiohead releasing their album as a pay-to-download thing off all the music services just on themselves. It looks great and it looks like it's heralding change, but actually it's just someone with a lot of star power swinging that around and showing that they can do things differently.
When I was in high school, I remember Pearl Jam boycotting Ticketmaster or whatever, refusing to tour with the number one booking service behind them or whatever that situation was.
If you're Pearl Jam. Yeah.
When you were Pearl Jam.
there's only certain artists who can do that. Yeah, I think it's completely right. I mean, I'd be interested to see if someone like Beyonce, she's quite a big artist, would she be able to do the same thing? I don't know. I don't think she would. I don't think she would do it, and I don't think she could. But it would be interesting to see if anyone else will follow her.
Well, I'm a big fan of Taylor Swift and of this album, and I hope as many people as possible find some way to listen to it.
As the official Taylor Swift correspondent for The Guardian in a completely unofficial capacity, I agree.
Good. For our UK listeners, Target is a huge US consumer goods chain store, a chain store that had a marketing windfall of global proportions this week, and all because of a checkout worker called Alex. Elena, why did Alex from Target become a viral phenomenon in the last few days?
In short, it's because he's quite good looking. I'm not even going to beat around the bush. Basically, what happened was...
How did it start?
Someone tweeted a picture of a guy named Alex. That's all we really know about him.
Did he have a name tag on?
Yeah, he had a name tag with Alex on. all we know is that someone tweeted a picture of a cashier at Target with a name tag Alex on, and next thing we know, he's all over Twitter. Everyone is tweeting about him. Teenagers are treating him as though he's the next member of One Direction. And he was trending on Twitter for about 2 days. It's ludicrous. It's one of those kind of things that you just cannot tell when it's going to happen.
Yeah, I watched the fruition of this latest human meme with some interest, because it just started, like, people were like, who is this guy? Well, it's Alex from Target. And people just started responding as if the idea of Alex from Target was inherently hilarious. And I think you're right that a lot of teenagers were attracted to Alex from Target. Loads of people become internet famous like this. What do we think sort of starts it off? Alex, in this case, why was Alex from Target?
Not you, was it?
No, it's not you.
I wish I had his devilishly good looks.
Oh, God. What are your thoughts on Alex from Target, Alex from The Guardian?
I think the thing I find interesting about this, and a lot of similar memes, is the way it exposes the incredibly disconnected communities at the heart of what a lot of outsiders think of as the unified whole of Twitter. Even people who are on Twitter tend to talk about Twitter as a thing. And I can certainly quote my friends and colleagues any number of times saying, you know, Twitter is very left-wing. Twitter is angry about this, angry about that. And certainly it and most other social networks do lend that appearance. But actually, there's nothing of the sort. And that Alex from Target is teen Twitter. Teen Twitter exists with its own rules in its own world.
And Alex from Target was approaching 300,000 followers when I checked.
He's now at 500,000.
Goodness.
Alex from Target is a bona fide megastar. And I do think it's the way teen Twitter operates. Teen Twitter is very focused around things like hashtags, around shared common in-jokes. Something hits it and it spreads far and wide. And if you think back to any time in secondary school, that's what being a teen is like. It's very much about identifying what is cool and showing that you are there with it. Whereas maybe adult Twitter, you see a meme and you're like, oh God, I'm not going to comment on that.
Why is this trending? Or I'm going to say, what is this again? And that's going to be my tweet.
It's a very teen response to go, I've seen that, I know that, I'm going to repeat that.
Teen Twitter is incredibly powerful as well. On the community team, we come in the morning and we tell news desk what's trending. The amount of times we come in the morning and it's something to do with One Direction, or that's the only boy band I can think of at the moment. There's at least a couple of others. Like, I think there's one called 5SOS.
Potentially Taylor Swift might be relevant.
No, do you know what? Less so with Taylor Swift. Okay. I mean, that does happen, but I feel like the conversation around Taylor is very different to the conversation around One Direction.
I recently read an article about, you know, the next generation of teen celebrities. Most of them originate on the internet and seem to become famous arbitrarily for having a YouTube channel or an appealing Instagram channel. Is that, Lena, is that something you've seen in your experience?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the people we're talking about in terms of Alex from Target, it's a different kind of fame to the ones where you've got YouTubers who just talk about their lives. Zoella is a perfect example of that. All she does is all she started out doing was talking about her life, blogging about it, telling people style tips, and then
Zoella is huge.
She's huge, and she's brilliant as well. I think she's excellent, and she's an excellent example of what you can do just by yourself without a media organization. Just with a camera. It's amazing.
And now she commands appearance fees to attend events, and the meet and greets for her are lines around the block.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous the amount of star power that these people have.
And most adults have never heard of Zoella, which is an example of Alex, what you were saying about teen Twitter being so separate from the way that people our age use Twitter.
And I do think, I mean, one wonderful example of this is Alex from Target is so yesterday. Today's meme that came out of nowhere for no apparent reason is a potato flew around my room.
Oh, yes.
Short 6-second vine of a potato attached to a roof fan with what sounds like a small child singing a song about a potato flying around his room. It's utterly bizarre, but it has 11 million loops on Vine. And hey, teen Twitter loves it. There's cover versions, there's parodies. Someone dressed up as potato flying around my room for Halloween. And it will be gone.
So what happens to people and animals like Grumpy Cat or Scumbag Steve or Good Guy Greg when they reach peak internet fame?
Well, Scumbag Steve is actually a really good example because he...
Do you want to describe the meme for people?
Oh, yeah, I should explain it. Sorry.
He's not really a scumbag.
He's not really. He's actually okay. Scumbag Steve's real name is Blake Boston. And the picture of him that's most commonly used is one of him looking vaguely confused in a doorway with a cap sort of perched on his head. And people...
He enters the room with a sort of expectant expression.
Yeah.
And he's wearing sort of a fur hood, so yes. He looks a bit glamorous.
And he just looks like, I don't know, people think that he looks like a bit of a scumbag in the picture.
The captions are things like, can I borrow everything? Sorry. So it'll have captions referring to his entitlement, such as, can I borrow everything? Or, you know, that he does something bad and then fails to make up for it. Like, you sort of start to personify him as the friend that always just kind of asks too much and always lets you down. But tell us about what Blake Boston is really like.
Well, Blake Boston is actually quite a nice guy from all accounts. He's done a couple of interviews since the Scumbag Steve meme took off. Actually, his mum took that picture. His mum took it.
And did
it was
the internet
on,
get a hold of it?
It was on his MySpace. Someone took it, thought, that's great, I will put some impact font over this, and then it went everywhere.
Gosh, what must that be like to wake up and realize a picture from your old MySpace has been completely personified as someone else?
See, on a serious note, I was reading something by Terrence McCoy from the Washington Post, and the article's really interesting. It's about Alex from Target and the exploitative danger of internet fame. And it talks about how it can be quite voyeuristic and a bit exploitative. I don't necessarily agree with all of that article. I think that sometimes people, like Scumbag Steve, for example, Blake Boston has actually ended up with, you know, a little bit of a rapping career off the back of it.
And
he's like an internet celebrity in his own right now, not just sort of a picture that people keep posting. But it can be quite overwhelming to have all this attention all at once.
Well, viral fame, a modern phenomenon. For more on this and other stories, go to guardian.com/technology. I want to thank our guests for joining us again today, Alex.
Thank you very much.
And Elena.
Thank you.
The festive season is fast approaching, so this year, while you're busy buying gifts for friends and family, why not treat yourself too? This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful all-in-one website building platform. With Squarespace, you can easily create your own website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. It's simple, and it'll be the one gift you know you won't want to return. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code GUARDIAN to get 10% off.
Technology is so fundamental a part of our everyday lives that it's very easy to think of it as a set of magical tools that appear just when we need them and effortlessly fulfill their intended purpose. But according to my next guest, the evolution of our technologies is mired in rich complexity and chance. Stephen Johnson is a best-selling author and broadcaster, a historian of science and technology, and his latest book and TV series is How We Got to Now, 6 Innovations That Made the Modern World. And I'm delighted to say that we have him in the studio here today. Welcome to Tech Weekly, Stephen.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So, Stephen, we often think of inventions as things that just kind of materialize independently. We learn about the creation of individual technologies and objects. But in fact, there's a profound interrelationship among these things that dates back into history. Isn't that true?
Yeah, I'm really interested in a way, the world of technology that doesn't look like the kind of gadgets that we obsess about. I didn't want to just write about smartphones, for instance, as much as I love smartphones, as much as I love the latest gadgets and everything like that. But I wanted to write about the technology that's been around and has become so ubiquitous that we don't even think of it as tech anymore. And to look both at the kind of history of these ideas and these breakthroughs, which in some cases date back, you know, thousands of years, and also to look at, as you alluded to, the kind of unintended consequences, these kind of strange lateral effects where someone invents something new, trying to solve a very specific problem, but that sets off a kind of a chain reaction in society where it ends up transforming realms of our world that seemingly have nothing to do with the original invention. So it's a different way of looking at history, right? Instead of telling history in terms of, you know, great leaders or great military conflicts, to tell history in terms of these
objects that we create and the kind of ripple effects that they have in society.
Yeah, innovations can have profound cultural effects too, can't they? For example, you know, we look at this smartphone as this very advanced piece of technology, but your first chapter is about glass, without which my smartphone would not exist. Yeah. I thought that was so interesting how, you know, different ways of experimenting with glass, or the fact that Venice was made of wood, you know, all of these tiny little elements of the fabric of life at the time that completely shaped the outcome of these the role that these texts played.
Basically, the argument is that glass as a material is the single most important material of the last 1,000 years to human society, which people hear and they're like, really? Because so I can drink wine out of glass or windows. That doesn't seem that transformative. But if you think about it, if you could kind of wave a magic wand and eliminate everything that was made of silicon dioxide, which is the kind of material that glass is made out of, you would not only eliminate windows and windshields and glasses, you would eliminate spectacles, lenses, microscopes, telescopes, every camera lens, every TV screen, every iPhone screen, fiber optics. Even fiber optics, the kind of backbone of the internet, is actually made of glass. So the internet on some level is made of glass, which is bizarre to think about. And so just imagine what would have happened to health and to science had the telescope and the microscope not been invented 400, 500 years ago. We would live in a radically different world. And so going back and looking at it, we don't think of glass as a technology, but when the glassmakers of Venice and Murano, the island, the kind of Isle of Glass,
which they were sort of exiled to because it was dangerous to experiment with glass making in a wooden city. Isn't that right?
I mean, to make glass interesting, to make glass, you have to have temperatures, above 1,000 degrees in these furnaces. And Venice, as you said, was at the time largely built of wood, and
kept burning down the neighborhood.
And it was this kind of trade off where that everybody was like, wow, this glass making is really valuable and it's bringing a lot of money into the city. However, you keep setting fire to our homes. So they sent them basically across the marsh to Murano, and they forced them to stay, the glass making community. They threatened them with the death penalty if they left, actually. And it created this, what we would now call a kind of innovation hub, where it was like the little kind of Silicon Valley of its day.
Because how did that centralization affect the advancement of their art and tech together?
Well, they were all kind of clustered together. And while there were different families that were competing with each other, I mean, it was a kind of a commercial environment, they were so close to each other that the ideas, when someone would come up with a new method, those ideas would just kind of flow from company to company or from family to family. And so very quickly you had this acceleration in the technology. And this guy, Angela Barovier, invented what they called crystal glass, which was the first really transparent glass.
Experimenting with chemistry in this very fine way.
Yeah, yeah. It's seaweed and all these, kind of strange plants that he'd found and just kind of tinkering. And it was kind of the maker studio of the, 13th to 14th century.
Yeah, I really liked reading about how the combination of community and competition really advanced the art in this very small location.
Yeah, there's a great term that economists have for it, which is information spillover. When you have, it's a great property of cities to this day. I mean, London has communities like this where you crowd a lot of people together, and because people are so close to each other, that there's a natural tendency of ideas to just kind of flow through the community. And so it's not just the competitive pressures of people trying to kind of outcompete each other, but it's actually the sharing of new techniques and building on other people's techniques
people
that leads
so
to innovation.
People are so close they can't help but observe and learn from one another.
Exactly.
Even as they're competing with one another, it seems that that's the sort of ripe for tech innovation environment.
Exactly. So they pioneered glasswork, and then the really funny story from that chapter is that I thought I knew the story of Gutenberg. I mean, he invents the printing press, movable type, and
suddenly
everyone
is reading,
sharing books, and of course that introduces all these revolutions because books are in circulation. But there's this interesting side effect of this, which is because everyone is reading, because the population is much more literate, all of a sudden, all across Europe, the reading population, certain subset of them, look at these books and they say, I can't read this. I'm farsighted. I can't read these little letters on a page. And interestingly, and this happens a lot in the history of technology, it was a problem that really wasn't a problem until books came along to expose it.
You wrote that people had no reason previously to even notice that they couldn't make out fine details until it was time to read.
You just didn't have, unless you were like a seamstress or something, you didn't have the need to look at small little forms close to your eyes. And so suddenly all these people realize, I need glasses. And so lens makers all across Europe pop up because there's kind of this market signal that says, hey, if you can make lenses and make spectacles, which had basically been only used by monks up until that point because they were the only people who needed to read.
Working by torchlight on the illuminated manuscripts.
Exactly.
I liked the second chapter as well because it had a lot about commerce in it, that some things that are a ubiquitous part of our lives now started out as really bad business ideas,
yeah,
like trying to sell ice in the tropics.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite stories. So this guy, this Bostonian named Frederick Tudor, who right at the turn of the beginning of the 19th century, he travels south to kind of the tropics. He goes to Havana and he goes to Georgia and South Carolina. And he's there in the heat of the summer and he's just overwhelmed at how oppressively hot and humid it is. And so he has this idea. He thinks, if I could go back up to New England and carve giant blocks of ice from kind of frozen lakes at the end of winter and put those blocks of ice on a ship and sail down to the tropics and sell people these blocks of ice, I'd be rich because ice is pretty much abundant. You know, it's just the cost of the labor and getting the ship.
There is no ice below the equator.
And there's literally, I mean, I think this is a funny thing to imagine, but if you lived your entire life in the Caribbean, for instance, in 1800, you would have never seen ice. It would not have been something that you would have ever experienced. And we hear this story, the idea of shipping ice in the early 19th century, and you think, well, surely the ice will melt. I mean, that can't work out. But it turns out, actually, if you do a little bit of kind of rudimentary insulation, you put sawdust around the ice, which was also abundant as just a kind of waste product of the lumber business in New England, You can transport a large block of ice quite a long ways for quite a long period of time without it melting. And so he actually figured out how to get the ice down to the tropics.
And everyone thought that he was just mad and had a terrible
Everybody
idea.
In Boston thought he was crazy. What happened, though, and I think largely because they thought it would melt. They just thought this would never work. But he figured out how to get it there. But the thing he didn't anticipate was that once he arrived, the locals were like, what am I going to do with that? Like, you know, they had no – he thought people would be like, it's a miracle. Like,
magic.
Thank goodness we can take a cool bath and make ice cream and all these fantastic things. And they
were
actually –
so acclimatized to the environment they lived in. They didn't see
We've been living here for 300 years or 1,000 years or whatever. Why? We've never had ice. What would we do with that? And so he actually had to kind of educate. He almost – he was briefly in debtor's prison.
Yeah, he had about 15 years before idea took off.
Yeah.
Right?
But then eventually he kind of – he created this kind of market demand for this new thing, and eventually he became a multimillionaire, made the equivalent of $200-300 million. And for a while, ice was the second biggest export from the United States, and he shipped it as far as India and Brazil. Queen Victoria apparently dined on New England ice, which was supposed to be the best ice in the world, which of course it wasn't. It was no different from like Scottish ice or something like that. But it, you know, it became this kind of luxury, and that ended up inspiring a new generation of inventors to come up with mechanical devices to make things cold. It proved that basically there was business in cold. And that set off then the next 150 years of innovation.
So again, if this man hadn't taken a really absurd gamble and lost all his personal fortune and taken this risky move to bring ice to the southern world, you know, maybe we wouldn't have had the refrigerator be invented in the way that it was.
Yes, that's right. And you look, one of the things I love about this story is to this day, you know, Americans are much more likely to have ice in their beverages. When I go to Brazil, and I'm down there and I'm, you know, asking for like an iced coffee and people are like, what? Like, you know, and I'm like, it's hot down here. You guys should totally have an iced coffee. And it's the legacy of this guy from 200 years ago who kind of created this appetite for iced drinks, that still lingers on in kind of the American palate.
Yeah, he almost subverted the nature of commerce. You wrote about how generally importing and exporting involves bringing things from high energy climates to low energy climates, and he did the reverse, and yet that resulted in an innovation that we use every day.
Yeah, it's very rare. Yeah, most of the, if you think of global trade in that period, it's almost all things like cotton or sugarcane or things like that, where you've got a lot of energy from the sun, then sent up to places where you have less energy from the sun, and ice is the one thing that kind of flowed the other way, basically.
When you look at the concurrent factors in the world around us now, after you've gotten used to looking at the world in this way, do you have any ideas based on the environment that we find ourselves in about what story might emerge next?
Yeah, it's a great question. One of the things that's clear from looking at these things is how hard it is to predict the future, right? Later in the cold chapter, there's a fun riff about how once we invent air conditioning, all these people in the United States move to the South, and that changes the electoral college so that there are all these voters in the South that weren't there, which then becomes central to Ronald Reagan's bid for the presidency in 1980. So the invention of air conditioning is directly related to the election of Ronald Reagan. You would have never predicted this in advance. You couldn't see, you couldn't think about it. So it is all that has made me more humble about making any prediction about what's really going to happen. But the one thing I would say to that I don't know what the full consequences will be, but we are at a very interesting point over the next 10 years in terms of the automobile. The automobile is being kind of reinvented on almost every level of how it's built, how it's powered, how it's used, who drives it. The electric car is finally making, I think, going to become a norm in the next 5 or 6 years. The success of Tesla is such an extraordinary story. Google has robot-driven cars that are now empirically better drivers than human beings are already.
Wow.
If we could switch entirely to a robot-driven fleet in the United States, we would save 20,000 lives a year in car accidents.
Amazing.
I mean, it's extraordinary. And then you have the Ubers and the kind of ride sharing and car sharing applications and services. And so basically every step in the chain of how is the car powered? Is the car controlled by a human or not? Is the car owned by a human or not?
What is our access to transportation?
What is that? All that stuff is, and basically the model for automobiles has been stable for 80 years, 70 years. And think about the impact that the automobile as a complex of technologies. Think about the impact that it had on cities and the design of cities, particularly in the post-war era. So if you reinvent the model of how automobiles work, it's going to trigger a whole host of other changes in the design of our communities and cities and work habits and things like that. So I don't know what's going to come out of it. I think it's probably good. I think it's, in general, a set of changes that will be good for the environment, good for people's lives. But whatever it is, it's going to be interesting.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
How We Got to Now is published by Particular Books, and we'll have links to it on the blog for this podcast. That's all we have for you this week. A big thanks to Alex Hearn and Elena Cressy. I'm Lee Alexander, and Tech Weekly is produced by Jason Phipps. We'll be back next Wednesday. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.